Brethren, we're blessed to have our brother Ted Martin speak to us this morning. And when I saw his title, I knew who it was about, and I think you'll also. His subject is A Man After God's Own Heart. A Man After God's Own Heart. Brother Ted.
A Man After God's Own Heart. There's no secret here. You all know that I'm going to speak about King David, of the tribe of Judah and the house of Jesse. He's the only one spoken of in scriptures as being a man after God's own heart. That description appears in two scriptures. The first is found in 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter, and occurs when Samuel is speaking to Saul, when the Lord is about to take the kingship from him. Samuel says in 1 Samuel 13, the 14th verse, reading from the New English Translation, because I think the tenses in here are correct. "You have behaved foolishly. You have not kept the command laid on you by the Lord your God. If you had, he would have established your dynasty over Israel for all time. But now your line will not endure. The Lord will seek a man after his own heart and will appoint him prince over his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command." When Samuel conveyed this message to Saul, he had no idea who this was. How could he? For the one whom this was said of had yet not been born. Samuel only knew that God had rejected Saul as king over Israel because he had disobeyed the commandments of the Lord. This rejection of Saul seems to have occurred after Saul had reigned only 2 years, according to some translations of verse 1 and 2 of this chapter. And if it was later, it still occurred very early in the reign of Saul. This statement that David was a man after God's own heart is repeated by the Apostle Paul when he preached to the brethren at Antioch, as recorded in Acts 13, 21 and 22. "And afterward, they desired a king, and God gave them Saul, the son of Cis, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up unto them David, to be their king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after mine own heart, which shall fulfill all of my will." Paul attributes the words of God to God when David is about to take over the role of king, replacing Saul. When Samuel went to anoint one of Jesse's sons to be the next king, he must have forgotten these words or let them slip his mind. For when Jesse presents his eldest son to him, he needed to be reminded by God of the qualities that God had set for the king in waiting. 1 Samuel 16, 4-7. "And Samuel did that which the Lord spake, and came to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming, and said, Comest thou peaceably? And he said, Peaceably. I come to sacrifice unto the Lord. Sanctify yourselves, and come with me to the sacrifice. And he sanctified Jesse and his sons, and called them to the sacrifice. And it came to pass, when they were come, that he looked on Eliab, and said, Surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said unto Samuel, Look not on his countenance, or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh upon the heart." God declared that the next king of Israel was going to be a man after his heart, so he was not looking on his stature or his outward appearance. But what did he mean that this man would be after his heart and he would look at his heart? It should be obvious that God does not have a human organ that pumps blood to his body, and the scriptures rarely refer to the physical heart of any individual. The first indication of God possessing a heart is given in Genesis 6:6, when the angels from heaven began to intermarry with the daughters of men. Genesis 6:6, "And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart." It grieved God that the opportunity for eternal life put before man had been spurned, and now even his angelic host, who had wanted to uplift mankind, now had succumbed to Satan and had been instrumental in the creation of an unauthorized race. It grieved God because he foresaw the evil and the pain and sorrow which would come to the human race. This shows that when God refers to his heart, he is referring to his innermost feelings, which are the basis of his love and justice. Another text that gives us an indication what is meant when the scriptures refer to God's heart is found in Jeremiah, the 7th chapter. Jeremiah 7:30 to 31. "For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, saith the Lord. They have set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to pollute it. They have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, to burn their sons and daughters in the fire, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my heart." It was in this valley that some of the tribe of Judah had erected a temple and an image to Moloch, upon which the parents would offer sacrifices in the form of their own children. And here God, through the prophet Jeremiah, disavows any commandment that in any way suggested that this was of him. He even tells him that such a thought never occurred to him, and he states that it never entered into his heart. Thus we see the association of the heart to the mind and the thinking process. On the other hand, God informs us through the prophet Zephaniah of the emotions that will fill his heart when once again his chosen people have returned to him in the kingdom. Zephaniah 3:17. "The Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save. He will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing." It seems clear from the few scriptures that refer to God's heart that it represents the emotional as well as the intellectual part of his makeup. It refers to his motives and his intentions as well as his feelings and his ability to experience either grief or joy. And so when we find scriptures that refer to the heart of man, we would logically understand that it refers not to his literal heart, but to his figurative heart. The heart in man stands for the inner man, that which comprises his desires, the seat of his affections, passions, purposes, his thoughts and perceptions and imaginations, his knowledge, wisdom, and skills, his total intellect, his beliefs and his reasoning, his memory and his conscience. It was when David was a young shepherd tending his father's sheep that he was chosen by God to be the next king of Israel. According to his own words, the highlights of that time of his life were his encounters with a lion and a bear from whom he rescued his sheep. He had been obedient to his father and yet was thought of with some disdain by his elder brothers. God was looking for a man that was in harmony with his own character and principles, one whose goals and intentions were to the pleasing of God, even though incapable of perfect performance. This he found in the young man David, the son of Jesse. There's no record of the age of David when he was first anointed by Samuel. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that Josephus estimates that he was 10, but that most other commentators think he was 15, and that is more reasonable. Brother Russell, in reprint 5662, says he probably was 20, which seems the most reasonable in the light of his duties and his accomplishments to that point. I think we are safe in assuming that as a shepherd, he must have spent many nights considering the God of Israel and expressing his love and devotion and desire to serve him. These were the things that God recognized as being after his heart. This statement, however, is not to be regarded as testimony to the perfection of either the youth or the man, but rather his fitness for the office to which God had appointed him. And as the office was one of great honor and trust, fitness as God's choice for the office implied a high order of character and ability, especially at the time he was chosen. After God declared him to be his choice as the next king of Israel, he began to train him for this role by giving him experiences which would demonstrate what were the principles that motivated him. What God saw in the heart of this young man would cause God to say that he was a man after his own heart. But what was that? The scriptures do not tell us what power God exercised to read the heart, whether he can determine from the principles that he sees ingrained in the mind, or whether he uses his ability of foreknowledge. However it is accomplished, we are forced to look at the life of David as expressed in his actions after God had declared him to be after his own heart, to see his character revealed, to appreciate what God saw. David's love and reverence for God were shortly manifested when he came to bring food to his brothers who were in Saul's army. Shortly after David was anointed by Samuel, the Philistines, behind their champion Goliath, began a march toward Jerusalem. Knowing that the army of Israel was led by Saul, their king, they were hoping to entice Saul into a hand-to-hand battle with Goliath. Although Saul was spoken of as being head and shoulders above the average Jew, he was by no means a physical match for the giant Goliath. Of all those gathered for the battle, it was only the shepherd boy David who was able to put the situation into the correct perspective. He saw Goliath's daily taunting not as a challenge to an individual, but to be against the army of the people of God, those whom he had delivered from Egyptian bondage and now had given the land of Canaan. He saw the situation as a battle between the God of Israel and the false God of the Philistines. He knew his God could and would deliver Goliath to one who went out to the battle in the name of Jehovah and was fully convinced that God would fight the battle. He had neither doubts nor fears of this heathen warrior and could hardly comprehend that no one in Israel's army from King Saul down to the lowliest soldier had not been able to assess the situation as he did. But he had one other advantage that no one else possessed. He had been anointed by Samuel to be the next king in Israel, and he knew that this encounter could not alter what God had decreed would come to pass. He eventually would be the king in place of Saul. And so the boast of Goliath that he would feed his dead body to the scavengers of the air and the land engendered no fear in the heart of David. David's demonstration of his complete trust in the promises of God was the first act on his part that vindicated God's commendation. Saul was impressed by David's victory over Goliath, and as a result brought him to the palace where he became fast friends with his son, Jonathan. At first, Saul was pleased with David and his ability to entertain him while playing on the harp. But things began to change after Saul sent David to fight against the Philistines and he returned victorious. He was received by the people and praised by attributing the slayings of 10,000 to him, and only the slaying of thousands to Saul. Jealousy began to grow in the heart of Saul, and soon it turned to murder, and he sought to kill David twice by hurling his javelin at him. Josephus suggests that Saul may have been possessed by evil spirits or demons, and although the scriptures do not give exactly the same thought, they do indicate that the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and that an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. If we consider the irrational behavior of Saul for the rest of his life, and especially his going to the witch of Endor, the thought of Josephus may have merit. At one time, Saul offered his daughter Merab if David would but fight the Lord's battles, all the while he was hoping that the enemy would kill him so that he would be innocent of his blood. When it came time for Merab to marry David, Saul gave her to another. He then offered his daughter Michal if David would slay 100 Philistines and bring him proof of the deed. David instead slays 200 Philistines and returns to Saul, who is forced by his own words to give his daughter to David as his wife. All of this seems to kindle Saul's wrath and hatred all the more for David. He attempted to get Jonathan and all his servants to kill David. He even went so far as to send men to watch David's house to kill him when they had the opportunity. But Michal, his wife, became aware of the plot and warned David to flee in the night. And when the men came looking for David in the morning, she pointed to a figure laying in bed and declared that David was sick. When Saul was informed of this, he instructed the men to go back and get David, bringing the bed and David in it. When the men returned to David's house, they discovered that David was gone, and only a stuffed image was in the bed. And this infuriated Saul, and he accused his daughter of aiding his enemy. Saul attempted to turn Jonathan against David by telling him that if David lived, Jonathan would never become king, thus intimating that he should help Saul entice him to come back to the king's palace, where Saul could have him killed. When Jonathan questioned his father as to why he should be killed, Saul hurled his javelin at his son Jonathan. We make references to these various incidents to show the depth of hatred that Saul had for David. Can you put yourself in David's place and realize that the king that God had appointed, who had the power to put his enemies to death, was determined to kill you? David became a fugitive not because he sought to usurp the throne, but because Saul had allowed his unfaithfulness to become the excuse to seek the life of the one that God had chosen to replace him. In Samuel, the 24th chapter, we have an account of Saul taking 3,000 of his men to find and kill David while he was in En-Gedi. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 24, reading from the New American Standard. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. The men said, that's David's men, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." With these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. Then David went out of the cave and called unto Saul, "My lord, the king." When Saul looked behind him, David bowed and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen to men when they say, 'David is bent on harming you'? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord gave you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lift up my hand against my master, because he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. Now understand and recognize that I am not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand." When David finished saying this, Saul asked, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And he wept aloud. "You are more righteous than I," he said. "You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. You have just now told me of the good you did me. The Lord gave me into your hands, but you did not kill me." When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. I know that you will surely be the king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." So David gave his oath to Saul. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. What an inspiring account. What an example David is in his reaction to the advice of his men to kill Saul. I could find no scripture where God said to David that he would deliver his enemy into his hands. But the thought does occur in the general promises that were given to Israel in Deuteronomy 28:27. David's attitude towards Saul is an example to us of the character that should be in the Lord's people of this age. He has a genuine love for his enemy that would not only not do him harm, but seeks to do him good. He shows how to carry out the principles that Jesus laid down for us in his Sermon on the Mount, and also in his instructions in Matthew, the 18th chapter. And more than this, he has such reverence and respect for God that he neither questions why he permits this already cast-off king to continue in office or to continue to seek his life. Let us examine ourselves to see if our motives or our actions are as commendable. Are we satisfied to wait upon the Lord's good time to remedy a need we have? Are we so in accord with God's principles that we would do nothing to oppose or in any way change the way God has ordained what we may see to be an improper situation? Do we think it necessary to take matters into our own hands rather than to wait on the Lord? Are we waiting patiently to be put into the position of power that has been promised to those that are faithful? David's patient waiting on the Lord was another facet to the man after God's own heart. While David and his men gathered about him, they were fugitives from Saul. For a while, they used the cave as headquarters. And while David was there, he made a casual statement in the presence of some of his fighting men. The account is found in 2 Samuel, the 23rd chapter, reading from verses 13 to 17 from the New International Version. During the harvest time, three of the 30 chief men came down to David at the cave of Adullam, while a band of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. At that time, David was in the stronghold, and the Philistine garrison was at Bethlehem. David longed for water and said, "Oh, that someone would get me a drink from the well near the gate of Bethlehem." So three mighty men broke through the Philistine lines, drew water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem, and carried it back to David. But he refused to drink it. He poured it out before the Lord. "Far be it from me, O Lord, to do this," he said. "Is it not the blood of the men who went at the risk of their lives?" And David would not drink it. Such were the exploits of the three mighty men. The journey to Bethlehem was perilous for two reasons. First, they were outlaws from Saul. And second, Bethlehem was at that time in the hands of the Philistines. But nevertheless, these three men manifested their admiration and their loyalty to their leader by bringing a water skin from his favorite well. When they returned and presented it to David, he showed the spirit of appreciation for the risk that they had taken by declaring that it was too precious and gotten at too great a cost to be used lightly just to quench his thirst. Instead, he poured it out on the ground as an oblation, a sacrifice of thanksgiving to the Lord for his care and comfort and support from such loyal men. Surely the greatness of David and his devotion to God were demonstrated by this act. And more than this, it reflects how he felt about those who followed him. He valued their lives, their love, and their loyalty to him, and would not be guilty of putting them in jeopardy only to satisfy his thirst. It marks him as more than an average man. It marks him as a noble man. There were several acts of David that displayed the condition of his heart in connection with the death of Saul and Jonathan. When David got the news of the death of Saul, there could have been a sense of relief, knowing that the one who had sought his life was no longer a threat. But even this was overshadowed by the grief over the death of Jonathan, who had been his best friend and one whom he had loved dearly. There certainly was not the natural human response of joy that he could now become the king. His response is given in 2 Samuel 1:11 and 12. "Then David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword." They mourned and wept and fasted because the Lord's anointed had been killed. David had remained true to his words that he would never harm the one that God had anointed to be king. He was content to wait on the Lord until it was his time to remove the one that had originally possessed such great promise when he was little in his own sight. In 1 Samuel 17:19 to 27, David offers this eulogy. He says, "And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been to me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished? Here we have a man who was hunted for the last 10 years by a king who had already been cast off by God. And after he is killed, says not one thing that would reflect on his despicable behavior. Not one word of the reasons that God had taken the kingdom from him, or his failure to keep God's commandments. He has only sorrow for the loss of a king and his son, and the effect that it would have upon Judah and Israel. He shows the character trait that Jesus commends to his followers in Luke, the 6th chapter, verses 35 to 38. There Jesus says, "But love ye your enemies, and do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again, and your reward shall be great. And ye shall be the children of the Highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be ye therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful. Judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Condemn not, and ye shall not be condemned. Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven. Give, and it shall be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down and shaken together, and running over, shall men give unto your bosom. For with the same measure that ye meet, withal it shall be measured to you again." In 1 Samuel, the 31st chapter, verses 8 to 13, is an account of the aftermath of the battle which took the lives of Saul and his sons. It says, "The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines, proclaiming the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths and fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. When the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard of what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men journeyed through the night to Bethshan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, and they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days." These men of Jabesh were not followers or even friends of David, but to the contrary, they were ardent supporters of Saul, because it was Saul who had gathered all the men of Israel and Judah to rescue them from the Ammonites, who had besieged their city and demanded the right eye of every male as a reproach unto the whole people of Israel. And so it was expected that these men that owed so much to Saul would be eager to honor the king to whom they felt indebted. by giving his remains and that of his sons a proper burial. But this feeling towards Saul and his sons was not to be expected from David. But his reaction is found in 2 Samuel. I didn't write the chapter down. It's verses 4 to 7. And they told David, saying, that the men of Jabesh Gilead were they that buried Saul. And David sent messengers unto the men of Jabesh Gilead and said to them, Blessed be the Lord, that ye have showed this kindness unto your Lord, even unto Saul, and have buried him. And now the Lord show kindness and truth unto you, and I also will requite you this kindness, because you have done this thing. Therefore now let your hands be strengthened, and be ye valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. David was not afraid that he would be honoring his enemies by sending this message of genuine sympathy for the loss of one whom they held in such high regard. He ends by telling them that Judah had made him their king, but he makes no suggestion that they should follow that example. He just wanted them to know that he understood their feelings and respected their actions. In this we see David exemplifying the spirit of the law to love his neighbor as himself. This same spirit is shown again when David becomes aware that the son of Jonathan is alive and living in the house of Ziba, a former servant of Saul. In the 9th chapter of 2 Samuel, he details how David restores all the land of his grandfather Saul to him, and then declares that Mephibosheth shall from then on eat at his table as one of his sons for Jonathan's sake. David's reverence for God is shown in his desire to bring the Ark of the Covenant from Kirjath-Jearim to Jerusalem, where he had prepared a tent in which it would dwell. When Uzzah reaches up to study the ark and is struck dead, it must have been a blow to David. He had a desire to honor and glorify God by bringing the ark to Jerusalem, and now God seems to be manifesting his displeasure in this whole matter. David then had the ark diverted to the home of Obed-Edom and went back to Jerusalem to confer with Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. He said unto them, Ye are chief of the fathers of the Levites. Sanctify yourselves, both ye and your brethren, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord of Israel unto the place that I have prepared for it. For because you did it not at the first, the Lord our God made a breach upon us, for that we sought him not after the due order. So the priests and the Levites sanctified themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel. And the children of the Levites bear the ark of God upon their shoulders with the staves thereof, and Moses, as Moses commanded, according to the word of the Lord. David, in his enthusiasm to bring the ark to Jerusalem, forgot to consult with the priests as to how they were to carry the ark. And it resulted in a painful lesson to all that the Lord's instructions were to be carried out just as he had given them. David spent that 3 months not in trying to justify his course, but in learning what the Lord's will was in the matter. He did not lose his zeal or his enthusiasm for this thing that he wanted to do, for he already had in mind the desire to build a house for the Lord once the ark was in Jerusalem. David had 10 sons by the wives that are named in the scriptures, and 10 more sons by unnamed wives and concubines, if I counted correctly. Of all those sons, he may have chosen Absalom to succeed him on the throne, for he had a great love for this son. But God had revealed the one that he wanted as the next king in 1 Chronicles 22:8-10. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Thou hast shed blood abundantly and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies round about, for his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. He shall build an house for my name. He shall be my son, and I will be his father. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Not only did God overrule any preference David might have had for the next king, God also explained to him why he would not be allowed to build a house for God. But David did not let that discourage him, for he then redirects his efforts to supplying the materials and even the plans for the temple. Is that not the way we should view our walk with God? If he closes a door of avenue of service that we have been enthusiastic about, let us watch to see if he will not open another. And when he does, let us embrace it wholeheartedly. When David was old, he was 70 years of age at the time, which doesn't seem so old to me. He called on the congregation. He called them together and introduced them to the next king. The account is found in the 29th chapter of 1 Chronicles. We don't have the time to read you the whole chapter, but I recommend it to you for your reading at home. In it, he gives insight into his thoughts and his desires and his reverence for God. He tells us that he set his affections on the house of his God. He set an example for his people by contributing from his personal assets to furnish the materials for the temple. And as a result, he inspired the leaders and all Israelites to do likewise. In verse 10 to 13 of that chapter, we are told that David blessed the Lord before the entire congregation and said, Blessed be thou, Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. Thine, O Lord, is the greatness, and the power, and the glory, and the victory, and the majesty. For all that is in heaven and all in earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come to thee, and thou reignest over all, and in thine hand is power and might, and in thine hand is to make great and to give strength unto all. Now therefore, our God, we thank thee and praise thy glorious name. Let us, as David, give all the praise and reverence to our great God who rules the entire universe. Some have looked at the life of David and said, He did some commendable things, but he also was guilty of adultery and murder. And they would question that if in that indicated a heart condition that could be approved by God. And we answer, these acts were not condoned by God, and they received a just recompense of reward. David was punished for these and other acts that displeased God. He was rebuked by Nathan when he failed to see how God viewed his adultery with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. It cost him his son. He repented of his sins and received the punishment that showed him the justice of our God. He was punished when he numbered the people contrary to the will of God. And he was rebuked by God through Joab for mourning for his rebellious son rather than acknowledging the loyalty of his followers. In spite of his weaknesses, he was loyal to his God and loved him with all his heart. When we read the scriptural accounts of others who have faithfully served God, we might wonder why David was the only one to be called a man after God's own heart. Why not Noah, or Abraham, or Moses, or Jeremiah, or Daniel? Some of these seem to have been every bit as faithful and loyal to God, and may not have sinned as much as David. We really don't know the answer, but we have this suggestion. When God said to Saul, "The Lord will seek a man after his own heart and will appoint him prince over his people," he was referring to David only in the typical sense. But he was referring more fully to the son of David, the one who would sit on the throne of the Lord until he had restored all the willing of mankind back to life, the one that he pronounced, "My beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." That man, Christ Jesus, was truly a man after God's own heart.